glad to be here, and the last talk was fortuitous, so I'm going to talk about the same problem, but how I'm thinking about it many years later. And here, in this talk, things aren't simple to compute. No, I don't know how to implement them. This is a work in progress, so I decided to do something with my graduate students and I at Vandervaart. We're working on, this is very complicated. For example, I've been working on it for almost a year and a half now. We've not really published anything on it. And so it's not ready for prime time, but it's interesting because of the way I'm thinking about it. And I think hopefully in the future it'll be useful and important. So the good thing is if you don't get it all, it doesn't matter because there's nothing to do at the moment. Okay, so let's just start with the simplest case first. The observed data, I'm sorry. One second. Oh dear. Hold on a second. I seem to have the right, probably the wrong file. Here we go. Okay. Started at the wrong place. Okay. So I'm just doing the simplest missing data example. I have underlying data L, which is Y, a binary response, X, a very high dimensional vector of always observed covariates, and R, a binary missingness indicator, and I sometimes see Y and I sometimes don't. I see Y when R is 1, not otherwise. And I just want to estimate the mean of Y, and I have missing at random. I shouldn't have that 1 there. It's just the probability R equal 1 given Y and X. Doesn't depend on Y. And if I define B of X, so the B of X is just the regression of Y on X among people I see Y, which of course is the marginal regression too under missing at random. And so the mean of Y is the expected value of that. And this is the propensity score, the probability of being having your Y seen given X. And we also have, it's also given by the expectation of the usual Horvitz-Thompson guy, which is the people you see Y, you reweight them by 1 over the propensity score. And I'm assuming this is bounded away from 0. I'm not interested in the identification problem. Okay, and so how would you analyze such data if you had NIID observations? Well, everyone knows that if you have a design study that was supposed to be designed, so the probability that you'll see W of X, the propensity score is known by design, the probability of including somebody in the study given their covariates. So if you have different sampling probabilities with different covariates, you just, here's the Horvitz-Thompson estimator. That's, okay, I was editing, but that should just be RI. I was editing another file. I think I get better after a while. So it's just RIYI over the propensity score, and there's no R there. That's okay. So the Horvitz-Thompson is unbiased. Of course, it's not efficient, asymptotically normal, and then half consistent. So, and we can get asymptotically 1 minus alpha walled confidence intervals for psi. We get the ATE there. So the problem is in observational studies, with missing data that is not designed. People just don't have data. Propensity score is unknown, so how do we proceed? The generalization of this is to what we were just hearing about is dependent right censoring or monotone missingness. There the observed data is, always see baseline X0. Then R0 is an indicator of whether you see something at time 1. We call it X1. Then we see whether you see something at R1, which is going to tell us whether you see something at time 2, which we're calling Y. And you see Y only if you didn't drop out at this one's 1 and this one's 1. So it means you didn't drop out at either. And if you drop out time 0, you don't get to see Y, or if you drop out at time 1, you don't get to see Y, but if you drop out at time 1, you get to see X1. So this is actually just different notation, what we were just hearing about. I'm not doing survival. Why is a binary response? I again want to know the mean. I again assume non-informative censoring or coarsening at random or missing at random, which says the probability R0 is 1, given the things you've all, the past that you've seen doesn't depend on the future, and the probability that R1 is 1, given the past you've seen, you have R0 equals 1, you're still around, doesn't depend on the unseen future. In that case, without going through all the notation again, the generalization, this inverse probability of censoring weighted estimator, it's just the generalization of Horvitz-Thompson. I take y, I have to be seen at both times, so I multiply the probability I made it to the first time, given x0, and the probability I made it to the second time where y is observed, given that. And that expectation is the mean of y. And so if I knew these probabilities, I just take the sample average of that, generalization of Horvitz-Thompson. And again, it's got those properties. It's not efficient. But the question is, what do I do if I don't know these? So since this is a longitudinal study, that's what we want to be talking about. But actually, believe it or not, the Horvitz-Thompson is so hard in the one occasion that I'm never going to get to the two occasion or the general occasion, because I'm going to convince you we don't know what to do with the Horvitz-Thompson estimator from sample survey. So that's, this talk is going to be about the Horvitz-Thompson estimator. So we're going to go back to the point exposure study. Our goal is to construct confidence intervals in an honest model. We don't know anything. We don't have a model. I'm going to leave everything unknown except maybe for some prior smoothness restrictions. We'll talk about those substantively later. So I want to actually do talk about math results. So to do math results, you actually have to say what you mean by smoothness. So I'm going to tell you what I'm going to mean by smoothness, and I'll make some comments about it. So here, x is a d-dimensional continuous random variable. So I have d covariates. We're going to make them all continuous. H is some function of x to R1. I'm going to call it holder beta with radius c. So beta can be like a number like 5.3. So all partial derivatives up to the biggest integer less than beta, so in that case 5, exist. And the fifth partial derivative, what's called the partial derivatives of h, there are many of them, the fifth ones, m of x, each one is satisfies this partial derivative of x minus the partial derivative at some other point, z, is less than some constant times the RD distance between those points times raised to the 0.3 power. Okay? So that's what we mean, holder beta. So you, roughly it's telling you how many derivatives it is. You can think of beta as 5.99999. This is really saying it's got, you're willing to assume it has 6 derivatives. Okay? That's the way to think about this. So holder beta is telling you how many derivatives you have. Okay? So our goal is to construct 1 minus alpha asymptotic confidence intervals with length shrinking to 0 as fast as we can get them to. We'd like the usual parametric rate, which is 1 over the square root of n. Given that I tell you, okay, that so b of x, remember what this was, that was the mean of y given x in the people you see y. This is the propensity score, the probability r equal 1 given x, and this is the marginal density of the 10-dimensional continuous random variable with respect to a vague measure, okay? And that's some function. And so I'm going to assume they lie in various holder balls. So beta sub b is the smoothness of this, beta sub omega is the smoothness of this function, and beta sub f is the smoothness of the function of the marginal of x. So now I've actually given you a completely well-defined model, because these, if you know these three distributions, that determines the joint distribution of the data, draw x, and you draw r equal 1 or not, or newly with this, then you draw, if you've got r equal 1, you draw y from the conditional distribution of y given x, and since y is Bernoulli, it only depends on its mean with this. So I've told you a model. That is, I've told you these completely determine the joint distribution. You don't know them, but I've told you what possibilities they are. They live in these balls, okay? That's a complete model. I have a set of allowed probability distributions. So I want to do confidence intervals. Okay, so you might say, well, let's say I don't know the smoothness. Let's say I just tell you these guys are, you know, measurable or continuous functions or something like that, okay? Well, Yakov Ritov and I in 97 proved that you can't even get uniformly consistent estimates of the mean of y if you make no smoothness restrictions. And if you don't have uniformly consistent estimates, that means you can't have any asymptotic confidence interval at all that shrinks to zero. You just have to do essentially the whole line, or yeah, 0, 1. So I guess the mean of y is between 0 and 1. Okay? So there's nothing you can do. And remember, confidence intervals, remember the form confidence intervals. What is an asymptotic confidence interval? It says there exists some n that's the asymptotic. Once you're big enough, that for all possible distributions in your model, you have an interval that no matter which of those is generated under, this interval covers the true parameter, mean of y, 95% of the time. Okay? And you can't do that with any interval that shrinks to zero unless you make smoothness assumptions like this. Okay? So in fact, you don't know how smooth these things are. So the first thing is, since I'm being serious about intervals, uncertainty, not just estimation, because often we really care about how well we know something. This is the mean of y in one treatment arm, and I have the mean of y in the other treatment arm done analogously. I want to know if there's an effect in this study, and if I'm assuming no unmeasured confounding, this is how I would do it. I just compare the orbit constant estimators in two arms. I really want to know what my alpha level is. So I really want the confidence intervals, which course turn in or equivalent to test. Okay, so since I can't do any, I just don't get anyone even shrinking to zero, I can't learn anything if I don't assume something like this. It's the first message is, and if you want to be truly non-parametric, you should report sensitivity analyses. You should say, for this smoothness assumption, here's the confidence interval. If you make some other smoothness assumption, here's the confidence interval. And if these guys, you say they have less and less derivatives a priori, the confidence interval is going to get bigger and bigger because you've got a bigger model or more functions. Okay, we'll talk about that more. Okay, so that requires some experts, if we ever did this and wasn't just a math game, to have priors about how many derivatives the propensity score function has, and so forth. And you might think, well, it's hard to imagine people having such prior beliefs. So that's an interesting question. Since we need prior, this depends on such priors. Maybe the number of derivatives and bounds on their size of the derivatives, that's what you see in the folder thing, aren't the right way to ask people questions. But with a long history of math, this is the way people tend to ask questions. So, for the moment, I'm doing the math about the typical way people measure the size of a model, which is the number of derivatives, and this is an interesting question about what we really should care about. But I'm going to use this model because it's the traditional one in the non-parametric regression and so forth literature. So why is Holder useful? Well, suppose h of x is Holder b star, then it tells us, so now I have no data. I'm going to do least squares on k polynomials, splines, or compact wavelets with appropriate number of vanishing moments. I want to know how well, here's h of x, it's somewhere in this ball, and I'm going to represent it by a least squares estimate that is a linear combination. This is population least squares, no data. The best linear combination of those k basis functions. How far off am I going to be? Well, this is called the approximation bias. When I use k basis functions, the distance here tends to be k to the minus 2 beta star over the dimension. So that's how well I can approximate this function by k basis functions. Then the other thing, if you follow non-parametric regression, if h of x is a regression function or a density, as ours are, what's the optimal rate of estimation? That is, if I use the cleverest nonparametric regression method, how far is my estimate of H from the true H in probability, or in LP norm or something? Well, with high, this distance in LP norm is with high probability of the order n to the minus beta star over 2 beta star plus the dimension, where beta star is the smoothness of this. And for rates of convergence, this distance will get, they'll be further apart when d is big. That's called the curse of dimensionality. Dimension tells you sort of exponentially. So this is the standard result from nonparametric estimation theory, and it comes, the way it works is you trade off the bias, which is this, how well you can estimate. So if you use more basis functions, you get less bias. This gets smaller when k gets bigger, but you get more variance, and that's how this becomes the optimal rate of convergence. So this isn't about anything I'm doing. I'm just reminding you of what's known about nonparametric regression and density estimation. Okay, now our goal is to estimate psi. Okay? Estimate psi. And so what we could do is do nonparametric density estimation to get the marginal of S. I mean, we have no other choice in our model. Nonparametric regression to do the regression of R on S, that's the estimate of the propensity score, and nonparametric regression of Y on X among people of R equal 1 to get our estimate of B. And remember, so we'll call that theta hat. That's an estimate of our whole data generating process. So our parameter is psi. What is it? Remember, it was the expectation of the mean of y given x. That is, it's the integral with respect to the marginal of x, our estimate of it, of the mean of y given x. That's our parameter. So this is called the plug-in estimate. This is the most natural way to do it, not Horvitz-Thompson or anything. It's just to go ahead and estimate the density of x, this, and take this integral. Okay? Well, this is known in the semi-parametric literature, non-parametric, not to be a great idea, because bias can be what's called first order. I'll explain what second order is in a moment. And what, since the 90s, people have known not to use plug-ins, but to use what's called the one-step estimator update of the plug-in. Here's the plug-in. And you add what's called the first-order influence function of the parameter psi. So every parameter has things called influence functions. Okay? That is, formally, if they're called smooth parameters. They have semi-parametric information down. So don't worry about that here. This stuff. So what is the first-order influence function of this of psi of theta? And we're going to evaluate it, because we don't know theta. We're going to evaluate it. It's a function of what generated the data, and we're going to evaluate it, the data. And it turns out to be this interesting thing. You take the first-order influence function is you take y. There shouldn't be a 1 there. It should be yi. You take y minus your estimate of minus its conditional mean given x. You reweight that by Horvitz-Thompson weights, and you add the difference between the conditional expectation of y given x and your plug-in estimate of the parameter. Remember, that was the integral. Okay? And then you add this guy to this. Notice this is in there, so that cancels. And the final estimator you get, which I'm going to call psi 1 because it's based on the first order influence function, is this guy. And if those of us, this is what we've been calling the doubly robust estimator of psi. Okay, why do we call this? So whenever anybody's been following this stuff, we've been writing on double robustness. It's always, you can always be going back. You start with a plug in and add the first order influence function. That's how you get double robustness. Why do we call it doubly robust? Why have we been calling it that? Well, you take the expected value of this guy under theta minus the truth. So I should have had a sub theta there, left the theta out of there. Theta's the truth. The bias is of the form the true regression of y on x minus your estimate times the true propensity score minus its estimate. So notice this bias is what we call second order. It's the product of how far away this is. So if that's small and this is small, it's very small. Okay? It's second order small. And notice, if instead of doing non-parametric regression here, I used a parametric model here and happened to guess it right, then you know b hat of x and b of x are almost the same thing. They're only n to the minus half apart. And you can see this is essentially zero. Even if you got that model wrong, if you used a model that was correct for the propensity score, you'd get a bias zero because of this term, if you use the parametric model. Now, so that's what we've been saying for a while. Use two, because these are high-dimensional problems, use two parametric models and hope you get one right. But that's always been,
if you think about it, that suggestion we've been using to say to do double robustness is kind of silly
because it's really cheating. It says if you guess one of two parametric models right, these really big objects, then you're fine. In fact, you get n to the half rates of convergence. You get the usual parametric rates. But if you're wrong, you don't even get consistency. It's this huge gamble on getting... We used to gamble on one model. Now we've been telling you to gamble on two models. If you get either of the models right, you get essentially root n, you know, 1 over square root of n bias here, or 1 over n bias, actually. Bias squared is 1 over... Anyway, you do fine. Okay, if you get either model right, but it's not a very honest thing to do because it says, oh, I'm doing great if either model's right. Well, why would you ever think you got either parametric model right? We think this is, it's X. You know, it's 10-dimensional, you're in this, you know, you have 1,000 observations, you're never going to get the model right, the regression Y on 10. So let's be more honest and let's try to plug in some non-parametric smooth. Now, it's a little hard how to think do a non-parametric smooth in this case either, but at least let's not pretend we're getting these right, okay? So we're giving up on double robustness because it was really a scam, okay? That's the idea. Okay, so how do we set, so what we're going to do is use some sort of smooths here, okay? 10-dimensional smooths, God knows how. But we're just doing math here. So the confidence interval, we're going to use the parameter plus the variance of our influence function to the 1/2 times, you know, 1.96, the walled interval. Now, the width of this guy, and to make life simple, because I'm interested not in rates, I'm going to sample split. So this seems weird to everybody, but we actually don't need to do it, but it makes the argument easy. So you can think of, I'm going to estimate the B hat, I'm going to split the sample in two, and I'm going to estimate B hat and the W hat and the F hat from 1/2 sample. And this sum is going to be, so the sample size is really 2 times n. This sum is over n people in one sample, but the nuisance parameters I had to plug in here were estimated from another sample. And I'm going to do all my inference conditional on the sample where I estimated these guys. So I'm going to treat these guys as fixed functions, okay, for all the calculations I do. Well, then you can see this thing's just a sum of IID random variables. Sum over I, these are independent, because these aren't random, conditionally, okay? So we know what the variance of this thing is going to be. It's going to be 1 over n, so the width of the confidence interval is going to be the usual parametric width, n to the minus 1/2. So this is the best we can do. This is the 1990s, doubly robust estimate, but we're being honest and plugging in non-parametric regression estimators. But are these confidence intervals going to cover? Well, it's very easy to figure that out. You know that for a confidence interval to cover, the variance, or the standard error, the size, the width of the interval, has to be bigger than the bias if you're centering it on your estimate. So we better, but we just saw how big the bias was. It was basically second order. It was this minus this times this minus that. So this better be less than n to the minus 1/2, because that's how big the variance is. Everybody see the picture? You're centering somebody at the wrong thing, you better be wrong by less than the variance. Okay? So let's see what happens. Well, when is that less than n to the minus 1/2? Well, we know how much this is. This is the best non-parametric estimate out there in anybody's toolkit. Adapt it, whatever you want. It gets this rate of convergence. This is the best non-parametric estimate where beta, I'm sorry, this rate of convergence. Remember, because this is the rate we can estimate this regression, where this is the smoothness I'm forcing you to give me a priori smooth, right? I'm doing it all within a model. And here's this. So I need this product, the product of the biases, to be less than 10 to the minus a half. Well, that's a complicated formula, so let's just do it simple. Let's say my a priori smoothness on the regression of y on x and on the propensity score function are the same. They have to be greater than 0.5d. If they're greater than 0.5d, then these guys are n to the minus a quarter or less, and I'm okay. So if d is 10 dimensions, I need to believe I have 5 derivatives, okay, in those functions, and all partial derivatives with all 10 arguments. And if I don't, how am I going to do? Well, I probably won't get good coverage. Now, if you read the annals in places where they talk about this stuff all the time, what they've been doing is saying they just assume they have enough smoothness to prove root n, that they get root n rates, and they call that efficiency. And there's not been any discussion what happens if you don't have enough smoothness. But since smoothness is not something you can choose, it's what nature has chosen, and you have to make a model based on your beliefs about it, what do you do if you don't have enough smoothness and you want honest confidence interval? Well, this double robust thing with the nonparametric is the best thing known up till now, and I can do it. Let's see how it does. Let's see if theory's right. So we actually have a simulation. Okay, k equal 1 is, so here we have the number of derivatives, what I was calling omega was called t here, okay? So if you, and we have 10 dimensions, as I said, so if you have 6 derivatives on both, this is the coverage of the interval based on the first order influence function. The doubly robust guy, pretty good. Here 5, that's the crucial, now it's a half. Falling down, these are 90% intervals, nominal coverage. It's falling down a little, and suddenly we go past that critical point. We only have 3 derivatives of each function. The coverage goes 39, 40, depending on other things. Finally, when we only have 1 derivative, it goes all the way to 0. So the best thing available doesn't give the right coverage when you don't have a lot of smoothness. And that's just with 10 covariates. We often have 50. Okay, so keep that there and go back to the other thing. So the question is, what are we going to do instead when this fails? Is there any way to get on a confidence interval? And the answer, that's what we figured out. There is. And it's to add to our preliminary estimate, not the first order influence function, but higher order influence functions. And these are connected with higher order estimating equations that other people have written about, usually in parametric models or increasing parameter models. There's a book by McLeish and Small, and a lot of papers by Waterman and Lindsay, the ones I know. But they haven't dealt with nonparametric models like this. But we're going to add a higher order influence function, which can be an nth order U statistic. So there's some, I had this magic first order influence function to add, which was the best thing to add among first order U statistics, because that's what it is, which is the sum of IID random variables. Now we're going to add second order things, and those should be able to solve the problem. And just, so I'm going to show you IF2 and IF3, and just so you can see that what's happening here. Let's just see what happens. So this is IF2 and this is IF3. So let's watch the coverage. As we drop, these guys stay pretty good, except, you know, we only have 1,000. These are asymptotic. So down here, this failure is probably because we're stressing the system, you know, for 1,000 observations. We're not in asymptopia down here. The theory is right. Okay. So you see, we don't fall off. We keep getting the right coverage. do we pay a price? Well, we don't. We insist on the right coverage. We want the optimal width, the smallest width, the confidence interval. So notice, even as the coverage drops for IF1, if we look at the length of the interval, it always stays around 2.5 or 3, because its variance is always 1 over n. It's the bias that's changing, not the variance. It's still the sum of IID random variables. So that doesn't change. Now watch what happens with our other intervals. They've got the right coverage, and they have variance only a bit bigger than IF1 until a certain magic point called 2.5. That's a 2.5 over 10. That's one derivative for every four covariance. You know, derivative over covariance is what's important. Up to a fourth, we basically, within constants, kept the same width, but completely protected the coverage. So this means this is root n. So down from 5 derivatives down to 2.5, these second and third order things have done miraculous things. They have allowed us to retain efficiency. We still have root n rates of convergence, because we still have the same confidence interval, but we've completely eliminated the bias. So they're quite fabulous. They solve the problem without paying a price. No loss in efficiency, solve the bias. That's between 5 and 2.5 derivatives. Once we fall below 2.5, they're still constructed not to have good coverage, but it's provable that you have to start sacrificing length. You have to get lower than 1 over the square root of n rates of convergence. And so to keep this good coverage, when we're now down to 1.25 derivatives, so 1.25 over 10 is the ratio, you can see that these guys have now gone up threefold in diameter. That's ninefold in variance. But that's the best you can do as a result, saying if you want coverage, that's what's got to happen. And so this is what the ideal is. Somebody inputs smoothness, what they believe, and output, we give something that is guaranteed coverage for that smoothness and shrinks as fast as possible, consistent with that smoothness. And in that sense, I mean, I'm overstating this, but that's the goal here, is to make data analysis no longer an art, it's science. You give me your assumptions, we put in a machine. Out comes the best inference. Next assumption, next thing, we don't. Okay, and part of that is because for confidence intervals, one of the reasons I'm discussing confidence intervals here, point estimation is more subtle, there's no adaption possible, essentially. You give me the smoothness, and if you say, I think the worst smoothness is 1.25 and 4, that says, remember, that ball includes something that has 6 derivatives, not 1.25. The scientists don't know the true data generating process, and you're afraid it could be really wiggly. It only have 1.25 derivatives. Then even if the truth is 6, I have no choice but to give you this interval, not this narrow interval, because the data can't tell me how smooth things are. That's all prior. Smoothness, if you think about derivatives, you always in data, it's always a bit apart, right? Smoothness is an ill-posed question. The data can't see smoothness, ultimately. And so what you really have is a map from smoothness, essentially, because it's really an ill-posed problem, to what's the optimal inference that has that much smoothness. But there's no empirical way to learn from the data how much smoothness there is. This is all somewhat of an exaggeration, because point estimates, you can do various things. Confidence intervals, you can pretend the story I'm telling you is right, because there isn't really any adaption you can do. And so this is the best you could do if someone wants to do valid inference. You want to valid out. You tell me the prior smoothness. Now, of course, there's another issue here. I'm doing a certain kind of smoothness. What if you thought, oh, there were a lot of derivatives. I had 8 derivatives on the first coordinate, but only 2 on the second. And what if I also thought, for some reason, that there was an additive structure, and I could separate the function of the 10 variables was a sum of a function of the first five, the last five, and maybe a third function of the third and seventh. Well, then, I'd like to use that. I mean, I'd like you to be able to input anything you want, and maybe tell you the optimal procedure. And your input is just telling me the size of the model and tells me how well the approximation is and how well I can, fastest rate I can estimate various regressions. That, the U-statistic part doesn't change at all. I use the same guide. It's just certain parameters, which I'm now going to explain to you, and the U-statistic change. So in other words, I'm not tied here to you giving me your smoothness, your understanding of what's going on, just in terms of this particular holder view. You can try anything. I mean, we haven't worked out the details for others, so I'll try to explain it in a moment. So the reason, while we're at it, the reason we use both second order and third order ones is there are certain cases where, for example, if you have 1.25 derivatives remember this is omega, and the propensity score and the regression of y, and four derivatives in the marginal of x, then it turns out that you can show the optimal third order guy is more efficient than the optimal second order guy, so you want to use the third order guy. You can make them both cover the right thing, but you want the best, so you actually want to search around for optimal one, and there are fourth orders and fifth orders and sixth orders, and it's possible, you know, we have a theory that tells you which one's the optimal one. Okay, so now that you've seen it, the question now is, what are these? You've seen what they can do, so what are they? Well, so let's start with the second one. So the second order influence, that's all I'm doing is adding instead to the plug-in the second order influence function rather than the first. Well, the second order influence function is actually the first plus a second order U statistic. Okay? And here, so second order U statistic, non-symmetrized, is you take the sum over the n times n minus 1 combinations ij, I'm also doing ji separately, it's going to be some function. What function? Well, that's what the theory of second order influence functions tell you. And this U statistic is a function for each person I and j of I and j's data. So what is it? It looks a lot like the first order guy. You take y minus its estimated expectation given x. You Horvitz-Thompson weight it. Then you multiply it by your first k basis functions from some expansion, you know. So we're using wavelets. Here's the first k wavelet basis, okay? And we're going to pick k optimally. So k is, you've got, you know, an orthonormal basis for, let's say everything's on L2, 0, 1. You have an orthonormal basis, you choose the first k basis vectors. They can be cosine, sine, polynomial bases, wavelets. We're using wavelets here, okay? You take the inner product of that for person I with person j. That's just the sum of I and j of the product of their basis vectors. You know, the first one times the first one, plus the second one times the second one, inner product. And then you multiply it by, just for person j, you just take rj over its estimate minus 1. Because these guys you're adding should be mean 0 under the truth, okay? Notice under the truth, if you had the true omega, this would be mean 0. R over pi would have mean 1. And this, of course, would have mean 0 because y minus expectation given x would be 1. And notice I need this to make it observable. So this is a guy, and it turns out to be this is the one and only, there's a unique, this is completely unique in nonparametric problems. There's no choice. The only choice you have is k. And so, how do we choose k? Well, we choose k, that's why we have to know the smoothness, to trade off variance and bias. So, I first have to ask, what's the variance of this, my new estimator? Because I'm going to use it, okay, so it's the variance of this plus this, because they turn out to be uncorrelated, two pieces, and it turns out to be the maximum of 1 over n, that's the variance of the first piece, and the variance of the second piece, the U statistic piece, is 1 over n, times k over n, where K, remember, is the number of terms I'm summing over. And believe it or not, we're going to use more than N terms. That's another aspect of this is an ill-posed problem. We're going to go past the data, where you would think the data has nothing to say. We're going past the empirical. We're going to use more than N terms, okay, when we have to. So that's the variance. Now we're going to choose K to make the bias equal to the variance, so the confidence intervals can cover, okay? So I have to know what the bias of this guy minus the truth is. So I just calculated, and it turns out that there are two pieces of it. One of the pieces is I don't go to infinity with these k's. Okay? If I went to infinity, I could get rid of a lot of the bias, what part of the bias, which I call the truncation bias, but the price I would pay would be the variance would go to infinity. So I have to truncate the expansion at k. That's the truncation bias, and it's exactly that thing we saw before, k to the minus 2 times the smoothness. And since it's a product structure, we get that was the approximation bias. What about the estimation bias? Well, it turns out that rather than having the structure I had before, the estimation bias squared, I have to be on the squared scale, is now, before it was this times this squared. Now it's this squared times this to the fourth plus this squared, this squared again, times this squared. So the point is, and this is where we improve, the estimation bias is third order. The square root of this, see, we got a 6 here, take the square root, that makes it 3. So before, the estimation bias with IF1 was second order. The advantage of going to higher order is you get another term multiplying here. You get third order bias. That's why the bias is less. Of course, you get a new part of the bias, which is the truncation bias, because you now have these k's and you can't go to infinity. And so we choose k so that this equals the maximum of the two kinds of biases. And when we do that, we get, if this is just what I told you, if we're less than a quarter, if we have less than a quarter smoothness, then we have to choose, if you do that, k is always greater than n. You go past the sample size and the number of bases, and the confidence intervals cannot shrink at n to the minus a half. That was at the bottom of that thing I saw. Am I done? Okay, I'll finish in 1 minute then. Yep. So this number here is the k we're choosing is n to this power. So notice once we fall below 2.5, we have to use n to the 1.33 basis functions. It seems really weird, way past the data. But that's a thing that will pose problems. But that's what you have to do to get no bias, but then you don't get n to the half rate. But if you're between a quarter and a half, that's where you can't use the first order guy because it gets biased. We saw it at a half. It doesn't get right coverage. Then k is less than n, if basically BF star is large, and confidence intervals do shrink at n to the minus a half. So that's where we get the efficient estimators, we get something for nothing. We correct bias without hurting the variance. And to even get our usual first-order efficiency, it's usual semi-parametric thing where we get parametric rates, we have to use higher-order influence functions to get them. Okay, so I'm done. Let me make one more statement. When I want to show you the bias here, okay, notice now that if I have either... Let's look at this term. Here I'm starting to get things like triple robustness. Instead of using non-parametric estimates, I was putting plug-ins here. If I get a plug-in right here for F, for B, or for the propensity score, here's the density of F, I get no bias. So another way to look at what these things are doing is that they're taking, if you don't think of non-parametric estimates, you think they're impossible, you're going to have to put in some parametric model. They're going from double robustness to triple robustness. So we go higher, we get quarter, fourfold robustness, fivefold. Okay.